evening. Happy Shabbat to everyone. My pleasure to be with you. We have our normal cast of characters, JB, Kirk, and Larry. How are you guys?
Good evening. I'm just fine.
Good.
Thank you.
Doing fine over this way.
Oh, hi there, Larry. You know, last week when I heard the clicking sound, that was me. I had to buy a new headset and new boom mic for my telephone. It was me that was shorting out. So,
you're kind of breaking up right now to me. I don't know if it is to anybody
too.
Else.
Yeah,
I wasn't sure
too.
If that was on my end or his.
Uh-oh, that's not encouraging because I bought the same one that I had before that I've used for years. It's just a newer version of it.
No, it's pretty
yeah, it's just
every
you're breaking in and out real bad. I mean, almost to the point where you're hearing every other word.
All right, I'm going to try the handset then. One second.
Okay.
Is that any better?
A little bit. Talk a little more.
Hello? Maybe I need to call in again. I don't know if it's my telephone line connection or what it might be.
Yeah, it might be.
It might be.
You're still breaking up a bit.
It might be.
Okay. Why don't you guys
you
go
do
ahead?
That?
Yeah, start without me, and I'll join you in a minute.
Can I answer a burning question left from Larry last week?
Go ahead.
Yeah, go for it.
As we were talking about names and knowing what somebody's name is, Larry said, you know, I don't even know what my name means. So my wife, Terry, she looked it up. So would you like to know what your name means, Larry?
I'm holding on to my chair over here.
You like it. It's Lawrence. It's from Latin. It's Laurentum. It's a place of laurel leaves. In the English, it's Lorcan, which means fierce. Characteristics are this. People who have deep inner desire to inspire others to a higher cause, to share their strongly held views on spiritual matters, and have quick tempers. How
well,
about that?
They did pretty good as a generalization anyway. I'll give them that.
You're well named. There you go. You're living up to your name. That's good.
Yeah, there you go. One of the things I'd like to point out, you know, I had said that Dode had 7,000 wives, and I misspoke. I've said it several times. He had seven wives, but he had a number of concubines, too. It was Solomon that had the 7,000 mm-hmm. wives. So
7,000 is still way too many for me.
Yeah, two is too many.
Or 700 wives, excuse me. Yeah, is seven's enough. Yeah, exactly. And it's because somebody had kind of sent an email, and I know they'd sent it over to Craig, and you know, I was the one making the mistake, and I have no excuse. I mean, I just confused the two there for a moment, but. Yeah, I want to take full responsibility and correct that.
All right.
You know, seven wives.
So that we all know, and I hope this is a better connection.
It is.
It's perfect.
It is irrelevant whether it was seven or 700. Well, we want to be accurate, clearly. And it's good that we clear the slate here. But the fact of the matter is the point that was being made is that he had more than one, which means that he would have been in violation of the second of the seven instructions that Yahweh etched, actually the third of the seven instructions that Yahweh etched in stone, and he would have been in violation of that when he went to the second wife, much less the seventh wife, and he would have absolutely have been in violation when he went beyond wives to concubines, and he would have further been in violation when he had his general killed so he could have one more wife.
Mm-hmm.
So the point that was being made was not in any way diminished by the quantity when the quantity exceeded one. So
that's exactly right. Because Dode, I mean, we've studied this now for months. Dode, and it really it's an earth shattering realization that Dode. You know, his personal behavior may have been abysmal at times, and it was.
That's good. Yes, in fact, it's wonderful. You know, for the
it's
very
good news for us. Yes.
It's wonderful for so many ways. First of all, it's Yahweh's nature. If Yahweh wants to introduce himself to us and announce his presence to his children, the person that he chooses to introduce his name to his children has a stuttering problem.
Mm-hmm.
That, what it tells you is all of these nincompoops that say that we ought not say God's name because of our reverence for it and that we might mispronounce it, they're idiots. If God chose a guy with a stuttering problem, to introduce his name to the world, then he doesn't care that it's mispronounced. Just make an attempt, make an honest attempt to say it. And if you mispronounce it, that's why I finally got to the point is, you know, it's Yahweh, and is there a chance that it could be Yahuwah? Yes. Does God care? No. Yes. Is it his one and only name? Does he care a lot about his name? Yes. But if we make our best effort through his Torah to understand how to pronounce it and we use it based upon his use of it, that's what he's happy about.
Yeah, I believe otherwise, that was the rabbis that said if you mispronounce the name, we'll put you to death. And by the way, we're the people that get to judge that. That's how they exalted themselves.
Of course.
And
Yahweh
never says you mispronounced my name.
Right.
Yahweh says over and over, you've removed my name. Not
right.
You mispronounced my name. Not ever once.
The removal of his name was such a big deal. The diminishment of the value of his name is such a big deal. It became the third of the 10 statements that he etched in stone, where the diminishment of my name, the negation of my name, is an unforgivable sin.
I'm going to say it's the only one
didn't
that he said he won't forgive.
Yeah, that's the only one. Yeah, he did not say that because Yada mispronounces words, I am going to really be angry with him for mispronouncing my name. No, he didn't say that. He didn't say that, you know, you better be perfect in your Hebrew diction or not attempt to say my name because it is really too special to be mispronounced. He didn't say that either. He just said, if you bring my name to naught, if you diminish the importance of my name, I'm not going to forgive you. So I would say that the opposite of that, since I don't want to be in the category of not forgiven, the antithesis of that, which is to be respected by Yahweh, to be appreciated by Yahweh, to be used by Yahweh, is to value his name and to say his name. Pretty straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But the reason we bring that up is because Christianity, the most popular religion in the world, is predicated on this Pauline notion that the Torah is a set of laws that you have to obey, and that if you in any way stumble on a single one of them, that the Torah will condemn you. That is the basis of the religion of Christianity. So Paul came up with a new, easier plan from Yahweh's plan. But the very fact that Yahweh picked a person who probably violated at one time every one of them, you know, a guy who really was not the best behaved fella ever, to say, this is the guy I love. This is my idea of a ideal relationship with a fella. I'm going to use disobeyed because it fits into the context here. That disobeyed every instruction that I gave him. That violated every instruction I gave him. And so that being the case, when you know that the guy that Yahweh says, I like this guy so much, I'm going to name him Beloved. I'm going to call him righteous. But more important than that, as I talk about people, I might mention Moshe in association with the Torah a couple of times. But throughout my prophets, and even with Yosha, I'm going to talk about reestablishing the kingdom of Dode. I'm going to talk about my love and affection for Dode. For all time, he picked this guy that was the least Torah obedient of anybody that we know of.
And yet probably the most Torah observant.
Correct. So the least Torah obedient person we know was the most Torah observant person.
How could you
make a better pick? I mean, isn't that just perfect of Yahweh? Isn't that just the way he is?
Let me suggest something to you. There's two rolls of dough when I think of dough, I think of him as a shepherd, and I think of him as a king. In the capacity of what we're told about him as a shepherd, he's flawless.
Yeah,
you know, he kills lions, he kills bears, he defends
he's
his
courageous.
Flock, he does everything absolutely correctly. As a king, he really stinks, you know, when he has the capacity as a king. So when we're talking about the 23rd Psalm today, I'm thinking about Dode as a shepherd. When if you're going to choose a kingdom based on Dode, I would think he thinks of him as the shepherd, he's great.
Yeah. Can I say that the part of this that strikes me beyond the fact that he's talking about our time in eternity, and I'm really interested in what our time is going to be in eternity, and I think that's why it's an appropriate psalm for us to discuss in this forum with family.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that struck me is something I had never realized until I said it this morning, and it struck me for the first time, which is I have never, ever heard anybody say, take me to your shepherd. I've never heard anybody refer to shepherd as a high-ranking position. You know, it's among the leaders of society, among the jobs to aspire
pretty
to.
Lowly.
Lowly as it gets is shepherd.
Yeah, they're going to rank that right up there with cowboy. You know, I mean,
cowboy is not real good.
No, we do movies. We write movies about cowboy. There's a lore about America, about the cowboy. We even have songs devoted to the cowboy. We don't have songs devoted to the shepherd. We don't have a culture that does shepherd movies.
No,
no one
we
ever
don't.
Wrote a book called, My Favorite Shepherd.
Nope.
I mean,
although in
shepherd,
reality, at the time of the cowboy, it wasn't a very good thing to be called a cowboy, you know. Sort of like being called dirt, you know, at that time.
But shepherd was beneath that. The cowboys despised the shepherds.
Yeah.
I mean,
one position
that
they didn't want sheep on their...
that's right. Even cowboys despise shepherds.
Yeah,
so
that'd be the low rung, wouldn't it?
Yeah, of the hierarchy of job titles, where the highest and most esteemed job title you can have, I think, is God. I'm going to put that one as, okay, that's
real
the highest.
There.
You know, amongst the lowest is shepherd. So here's the most important of all psalms to describe our eternity. You know, the 119th psalm, which we just concluded, tells us how to observe the Torah. And, Larry, you said something here, I think it was you, Larry, that is stunningly profound. While Dode was the least obedient, Torah obedient person in all of history, he was the least Torah obedient person that is chronicled in the Torah prophets and Psalms. He was the most Torah observant. And so we have the 119th Psalm that explains how to be Torah observant from the most Torah observant person in all of history. And this Torah observant person now is explaining what the relationship is going to be like with God now that he has benefited from the Torah, and he presents God in the most lowly of positions. And he's inspired. So he's not writing his opinion. He's putting Yahweh in the most lowly of positions.
And that's a beautiful that's a beautiful thought because
it takes God down to an approachable individual level.
Absolutely.
Yeah, who of us would be afraid to talk to a shepherd? Yeah, you know, nobody. But nobody.
Who would be afraid to follow a shepherd?
Nobody.
Nobody. Yeah. Who would be afraid to approach a shepherd? No one. And so what he has done is say, okay, God has the highest title there is. He's the most supreme being there is. He's the most almighty being there is. And I'm going to give him a title that from man's perspective is lowly, but from a relationship perspective is as good as it gets. I mean, the only title that is better than shepherd in terms of our perspective as father.
About it, you but, know, I mean, it's profound. It's profound.
It's profound.
You know, I've heard the father before, but never the shepherd. I never really considered it. Now, I did consider, you know, Yahweh's messenger, the lamb.
Right.
A lamb not being particularly vicious, easily approachable,
right.
Pretty friendly
right.
animal, truth be told.
Right.
And then, right. you know, when we look at him being a shepherd, and he says that all through the shepherd's staff, he's, you know, wow. Yeah,
right.
You're right.
Oh,
I mean, that's just another example of his true nature, which is the opposite of religious teaching, of course.
Right. Opposite of Lord. It's God is approachable. He does not want us to lift him up, doesn't want us to worship him, doesn't want us to praise him, doesn't want us to put him on a pedestal. He's very comfortable with what he is, and he created us for the express purpose of enjoying our friendship, our relationship, our affection. And he's willing to get down on his knees to lift us up, so that we can enjoy his guidance, his leadership, his shepherding. And by the way, in this shepherd thing, and I think it's really important, we had Jason today talk about how you know, Christian teachers say that, you know, sheep are skittish, so the waters had to be still. That's why they talked about still waters. And I said, bull, that's absolutely ridiculous. Well, Dode is equating to Yahweh the concept of shepherd. You cannot for a moment go the other way and equate us as sheep. Yahweh's not trying to dumb us down. Dode's not talking about sheep here. You know, it's Yahweh wants us to be like him, to enjoy his company. And this whole presentation is about properly identifying who Yahweh is and how he is going to spend his time with us in eternity, and how we're going to spend our time with him.
Don't you think that's like unbelievable, that the God of the universe invents everything, makes everything, creates everything, and his big thrill is to spend all his time with us? That
as our shepherd,
away. Yeah.
As our shepherd, as our father. No, it doesn't anymore.
I know, but the concept
is
just amazing.
And I find it reaffirming when he says it, because I used to feel really uncomfortable. I came to the realization years ago that Yahweh doesn't want to be put on a pedestal. He doesn't want us praising him. He's not insecure. His whole idea is that he gets down on his knees to lift us up, and he wants us just to be straight with him, just, you know, walk with him, shoulder to shoulder, eye to eye, and enjoy his company, relax around him. And when I figured that out, I felt uncomfortable saying it, because I knew that anybody I said that to outside of family is going to view that as blasphemy. You know, my God doesn't bow down to me. I bow down to my God. And I said, no. Why would you want to do that? But you can't lift him up. And his whole purpose is to lift you up. So why are you going to go in the opposite direction?
Farther away from him.
Right. Why would you counteract what he said? That'd be like, you know, going back into the bar where I put down a quarter to buy the beer, and rather than putting down the quarter to buy the beer, I take the guy's money from the bartender, take the drink, and tell the bartender, you know, too bad. I mean, it's just everything's wrong with that notion. So now it's just comfortable. And I find it reassuring every time that I find reinforcement in his testimony that that's how he wants us to approach him. Don't be awed by it.
Yeah, and that it is a profound thought. It's very profound. It's the same. Look, we've been through the 119th now, and I think the most profound thing of the 119th was Dode saying that no matter what I've done, it was nothing. It didn't count. What I do
right.
in my life doesn't count. And when I right. thought it did, I was lost. I mean,
right.
that's the big thing there. It's the way I respond to your mitzvah,
yeah.
you know, the choke.
Yeah.
It's responding
right.
properly. And the way we respond properly is by telling people to observe the Torah. And I think, you know, probably the biggest thing I get out of the Torah, truth be told, the most huge thing is Yahweh's nature. Yahweh's nature is nothing like we were told. It's the exact opposite.
Yeah, that's half of what I get out of it. I get, I guess, three things out of it. Yahweh's nature, which I really like. I mean, I think he's the coolest, most fun, down-to-earth, approachable dude. I mean, I he's smart, he's fun, he's funny, he's engaging. I like him. You know, and okay, this to use the, you know, this term that, you know, Christians use, you know, just, don't you love the Lord your God? You know, I think that when you get to the point you just like being with somebody, you have fun with them, that's a really great position to be in. So that's, I would agree, that's a big part of it. The second big part of it is when we come to understand that all of this guidance, all of this instruction, all of this teaching is about encouraging us, inviting us to be part of his family. Now, I like the family metaphor, the being in his home, being his kid, inheriting what he has to give, enjoying our relationship as father-son. So I'd say that's the second part of it. His nature and the offer and the nature of the covenant family. And then the third part of it that I've come to love is this realization that we are on a voyage of discovery. And that voyage of discovery isn't going to start when we become a spiritual being. It starts right now. And
well, yeah, those are all there. Those are all there. Obviously, you know, who could pass up the benefits? That's an example. I mean, don't even mention them. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Okay, that's the fourth one. I rather like the benefits. I do. I like the benefits.
Yeah.
I really do, yeah. The benefits. Life is short. I like being immortal. I'm flawed. Being perfect appeals to me. I have learned that the more you have, the less you have. And the less you have, the more you have. And so inheriting what Yahweh has to offer and not worrying about what I have, it really appeals to me, you know. It appeals to me that I'm going to be freed of my physical limitations and be empowered. It appeals to me to be enriched because I make too daggone many mistakes. I'm looking forward to being enriched with his testimony and empowered by his spirit. All those things really appeal to me.
Well, if you could buy them, if you're in a situation where you could buy them, that's what you'd spend.
You pay everything you had for them. Yeah, you
pay absolutely.
Everything you had for them. And yet, he's not asking anything.
No.
I mean, I guess the only thing he's asking is that we don't screw it up for him and everybody else. Just, you know, come in and with the proper attitude. Don't drag all the scummy dirt with you. Don't ruin it for everybody else. You're welcome. Just don't screw it up for everybody else. Otherwise, I'm going to give you everything. Just don't give me heartburn and a headache in the process. So I think that this psalm that we're thinking of, that we're going to invoke here, it has absolutely nothing to do with Dode's life. Dode, at no time in Dode's life was did he lie down in the grass or seek shelter was at no time in his life was he without want. He was the most covetous, wanting guy that we know of in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. And by the way, wanting is a very good thing. If you don't want, if you don't want to grow, if you don't want to know Yahweh better, if you don't want to love more, to learn more, then what's the purpose of your life? We all want to grow. We all want to learn. We all want to be better. So we all want. And there's no time that Dode didn't want. There's no time that Dode was peaceful and tranquil. I mean, he was a go-getter. And there's no point that Dode was ever timid. So this has nothing to do with Dode's earthly life. It has all to do with his understanding and his giving us a glimpse into eternity. And so what we talked about today I thought was also interesting in how the religious publications, the Bible, absolutely destroys this passage. You know, it begins with, the Lord is my shepherd. And That is so stupid. It's so stupid now, it just hurts. How could you call a shepherd a lord? You know, if you think at any time in human history, was there a lord that went out and said, you know, hey, all my lowly shepherds out there, I want you to go into my palace, and you get the fine food at the fine table and the really comfy bed and all the concubines and all that kind of stuff. You all get all of my money and all of my my worldly possessions. I want to sit out here and sleep on the grass and hang out with these sheep.
Well, now that you said it, yeah, it's of course we're programmed to be able to recite that practically from the time we can walk. Even if you're raised in an atheist household, you hear it all the time.
I do that one.
That's just another one of those oxymorons like jumbo shrimp, you know. I mean,
yeah, it is.
There you
The Lord is my shepherd is an oxymoron like jumbo shrimp. There's no such thing. Yeah. So it is. But Yahweh can be our shepherd. And then the the second part of this, which is I shall not want, which it says that in every English translation, we all were programmed to say that. If you get to the point in your life that you don't want anything, you're dead. You're dead. You're either dead or you're a vegetable.
Or you're living a life not worth living.
You're living a life not worth living. Yes, exactly right. I mean, we get up each day hoping to accomplish something that day, hoping to learn something that day, hoping to contribute something that day, hoping to love that day, hoping, you know, to just the whole idea of growing, being a little better today than we were tomorrow. That's what we want. And even, you know, to want doesn't mean that you covet meaningless things. You can want very profound, very important, very long-lasting, meaningful things. But Yahweh has wants. You know, almost every verb, I shouldn't say that, many, many verbs in Hebrew have moods. And all of the moods express wants. Every time that a mood is conveyed in Hebrew, it's expressing a want, a desire, a will, a choice. And so why would Yahweh have a language that is specifically crafted where every mood conveys a want? If the cessation of wanting was the consequence of being shepherded.
Oh, absolutely. You're right. I mean, you should want this. You should want that. I mean, he tells you that. Sure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
see why religious would change it to want. Because that is what the religious people want. They want to be told what to do. They don't want to have to think for themselves or do anything. They just want to be told what to do, when to do it, and, you know, that's all.
I'll tell you what puts me to mind, though. It puts me to mind of Paul saying, you know, when he describes what love is, he says, love is not jealous. You know, everybody runs around talking about how they're not a jealous person. But, you know, Yahweh says he's a jealous God. You know,
didn't even say that love does not speak its own. Didn't even say that love does not speak its own. Yeah,
doesn't do what,
Neil? Seek its own. I mean, it's
everything
that he says about love is untrue. Wrong.
Yeah, it's an opposition. Yeah.
You know, when you love, you want to be loved in return. When you love, you are absolutely jealous. I mean, if I love my wife, if my wife were to go off and love another man, I'd be heartbroken. You know, I love my son. If my son were to say, you know, I don't want to spend any more time around you as my father. I want to choose a man that I like better as my father. I'd be crushed. I mean, when we love, we want to be loved in return.
Right. I mean, and that's everybody. That's a natural state of affairs. I mean, it really is. And it's the same thing we got here. I shall not want. Well, I've sure been in positions where I've wanted many times. Hmm. Many times.
Now, one of the things is not to be diminished. Low chest hair. I don't want to be decreased nor made void. I don't want to be found lacking.
Yeah, part of why we're here.
Right.
I don't want to be
diminished.
I'm diminished
or bereaved.
But I want to do more than just live. I want something, you know, I want to do all that other stuff.
Yeah. So it's the Song of Dode. Yahweh is my shepherd. And shepherd here, Ra'ah, means that he is an observant guide. He nurtures, tends to, and protects us. It's from the word Ra'ah, which means to see, to obtain understanding from a proper perspective through observation. This conveys something that is, on that profound scale, is really high up there, maybe a 9 for me. And that is that I've came to realize, and we've shared this before, that Yahweh created the universe and conceived life because he wanted to have relationships. Relationships in a family setting is the only way that God can grow, and if God doesn't grow, his existence becomes meaningless. And so it's those relationships that cause him to grow. What I had not thought about. Now, I thought about with you all how much more fun eternity is going to be to have unique personas, different perspectives, your perspectives, to share it with. You know, it's one thing to go out there and see a new planet. It's another thing to go out there and see a new planet with my friends, with my family. And so I realized, you know, that's going to be the cool part of being part of a family as we go off and explore. But then when you realize that Yahweh said that he is observant as a shepherd, what it tells me is that Yahweh is just like we are. Yeah, he created a really cool universe. But what fun is that if he can't share it with anybody?
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, you know, you've experienced that, haven't you? You've experienced that, Craig. I mean, let's say you're staying in a 5-star, 5-diamond hotel. Except it's one of these business trips your wife couldn't go on. And so you're sitting there with your 5 televisions and your 2 bathrooms and your beautiful view of the mountain with nobody to share it with. Boy, you know, you might as well be at Super 8 because that's how much fun you're going to have.
That's exactly right.
I mean,
I've been there a bunch of times.
That's how I felt.
I know you have.
I've been there a few.
Yeah.
And if I got my wife with me, it becomes a whole different thing.
Different.
A completely different thing.
Yeah. When I travel, if it's just me, I go to the cheapest motel. When I travel with my wife, I don't. I want to find a nice place because I want to experience it and share it with her. It's a whole different mentality. Yahweh created a really nice place. It's called the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And he wants to share it. And I think that Roy said something that it may have been actually Kirk and Roy combined,
mm-hmm.
which is that while Yahweh has the ability to know the future at any one moment, and while Yahweh could see how his universe is unfolding from his creation at any time, I don't think he does.
No.
I think that even in his relationships with us, he enjoys watching them and seeing them develop. And I think he is going to go see what he created, and he's going to be just as surprised as we are, just as excited to see it as we are, because he has chosen not to know these things.
Yeah, we've speculated that that's the half of the fun for him. Why? It would not be fun for him if he knew it all anyway. I mean, it's nice to show you what he's already discovered, but why would he not want to discover it too? That doesn't diminish him in any way. You know,
so here's this psalm talking about our relationship with Yahweh as our shepherd for all eternity, and the word used for shepherd is ra'ah, to see, to observe, to come to a certain perspective that enables you to understand, to pay attention. I don't think that's a coincidence.
No, I don't either.
I think we're learning more about Yahweh's nature, his purpose for creating us. He wants to go off and explore with us, and he's going to have as much fun as we do.
You know, I think that's one of the reasons that that ecosystems work the way they work. I was watching a show the other day on predators, and you know, the person was going over the ecosystem, and they said, you know, if it wasn't for the lions, and if it wasn't for the jaguars, and if it wasn't for the hyenas, and if it wasn't for the crocodiles, one of my least favorite creatures, they would overgraze the land.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, that's right.
Yeah.
Even the predators have a place there.
Yeah. Right.
You know,
If
that's why...
On our farm in Virginia here, if because the predators have been knocked way down. There used to be wolves here. There's no more wolves. There are a few coyotes, but they're few and far between. We have a bobcat here on occasion, but everybody wants some of the bobcat as a trophy for their wall. And so the deer proliferate because they have too few predators. And as the deer proliferate with too few predators, they start to mutate, and their mutations are all negative.
Hmm.
And they become unhealthy.
Oh, they mutate as well.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
In a brain,
absolutely. Yeah, you get all sorts
because
of
the weak ones aren't ferreted out. That's the other side. There's another example. Yeah.
Exactly. The weak
wow, so you got two things going on there.
Correct.
And that goes with Yahweh allowing free will. Everything's got a purpose. They just got to go out there and go for it. I mean, our purpose isn't to, save the planet. We can't save the planet, but we can share something that could work eternally in somebody's favor.
For
and
those who are vegetarians that think it is immoral to kill an animal to eat it, would that make a lion an immoral animal?
That's absurd.
It's absurd. Right. Now, I think that we were talking about this today with one of my guys, and I think to kill an animal because you enjoy the sport of killing, I think that's pretty messed up. I think to kill an animal
makes you a jerk.
You want to eat, and you like venison, for example. When we hunt deer on this property to come to some semblance as to what is an appropriate number that the land can support, the guys that hunt them have a certain set of rules. The animal cannot suffer. You have to have a means of do not take the shot unless you can have a kill shot. The animal cannot suffer. If that animal suffers, you can't hunt here anymore, and you need to immediately dress that animal and consume. And that animal, the meat, is food. And if it's not food, you don't hunt. We don't hunt for sport. We hunt for food.
Good for you.
And so
come here and hunt some deer for off your land.
There you go.
Deer leases are expensive.
Yeah. And there's some animals, like for example, in turkeys. If you don't shoot some of the gobblers, you will dramatically decrease the turkey population because the gobblers are so covetous of the females. They'll go and kill all of the young chicks. They'll go in the nest and break all the eggs because they don't want competition from a potential future gobbler.
Wow, I didn't know.
Lions will do that too. They'll eat the children.
Yeah. Now one thing I don't know. Geese are dirty. They're beautiful from a distance, but they're dirty, crapping all over everything. But I don't allow anybody in our farm to hunt geese because of the marital bonds of geese. Geese mate for life, and their extended family stay together for life. And any animal that devoted to their young and to one another, and if one of the two were to die, that goose does not recouple. And so I just said, you're not going to shoot geese. Yeah, geese are monogamous and forever. And so if you see a goose alone, that's because the goose's partner, male or female, has died.
It's
lots of interesting examples in the animal world. All right, so a mezmor, a song set to a lyric set to a melody of Dode, beloved. Yahweh is my shepherd. He is observant. He guides me, nurtures me, tends to me, protects me. In other words, Yahweh here is doing all of the work. All of the service is coming from Yahweh to Dode. Dode didn't say, I am nurturing Yahweh. I am serving Yahweh. I am, doing this for God. No, it's God doing all of this for Dode.
By the way, do we have this anywhere in ITG or yada yada, or is this just...
I should what I should do is send the translation at least as far as I've gotten, and I'm going to work some more over the weekend. So I'll share it today just from I got so snake bit the last time that I shared the translation of God's exemption on food and got so much grief on that. I'm just a little gun shy on this, so excuse me.
But now what I will see the bound couple.
I hope that doesn't deter you because I can't wait to read it.
Okay.
Yeah, I do.
From reading and from
what I'm hearing here, this doesn't sound anything like we've been told, which is no surprise to me, by the way. Okay.
No, it's nothing.
I mean,
nothing
I would
like
be surprised if it was even close. Yeah.
Larry,
and
Larry,
I will tell you that the other thing that I have done here that I have never done to this extent before is that I have looked longer and harder to all of the amplified and potential meanings of the words. And I was never satisfied until I looked at other places where the word was used and tried to discern meaning that was conducive to those other uses. And this is the first time where I've used as a primary source the shapes of the letters. I've used as secondary sources. You know, Kirk uses the primary source, the shapes of the letters. And I use the lexicons and roots as the primary source, and then I'm affected later by the shapes of the letters. This is the first time I ran into words where the shapes of the letters and the picture they drew was my primary definitional and explanatory means.
Well, I could throw about four or five lexicons, too, so I mean, just to double-check before I rely totally on the, I mean, y'all's about his word, a lot more than he's about his letter, but I mean, it's amazing how much the letter reinforces the word. It's just,
Well, I'll give you an example. The first one I did here, Ra'ah, shepherd.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
right.
Ra'ah, and you won't find Ra'ah as in Rosh Aleph Hay. You will not find it associated in any way with Ra'ah, which is Rosh Aleph, excuse me, Rosh Ain Hay.
Mm-hmm.
Because shepherd is Rosh Ain Hay.
Right.
And to see is Rosh Aleph Hay. Now, they're pronounced exactly the same way. They're written and transliterated the same way in English. And so when I saw Ra'ah, I immediately said, to see, because it's one of the most common verbs in Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
It means to see, to observe. And I really like Ra'ah because it speaks of observing from the proper perspective to facilitate understanding. So it fits my whole concept of how do you think, how do you come to know, how do you deduce that which is trustworthy and not of Yah, of not of Yah, is the proper perspective. Observing from the proper perspective makes all the difference in the world in terms of understanding. So I saw Ra'ah as shepherd, and immediately it just screamed to me to see. Now, there is nobody else making that connection. Is that a reasonable connection or not? You know, the reason I accepted it as a reasonable connection, even though the middle letter is different, a Ain versus an Alef, how was the Ain drawn? Kirk?
More than that.
Yes. So the one that doesn't mean to see, that means shepherd, is the one that has in the middle of it an eye. So at that point you say, okay, at that point, how is it possible that shepherd, the one with the ain, the one with the eye in the middle of it, doesn't convey the idea of seeing, of observing? And so that's the process that I use. Now, is there anybody that translates Hebrew that's going to, you know, if you were a scholar, would you accept that?
Scholar.
Would you accept that there is an I in the middle of, and by the way, you know what the Hebrew word ain means, the letter, the name for the letter? Do you know what the name of the letter means? Ain?
What do you mean, besides observe?
No, the letter
oh, the
ain,
letter
which,
is, yeah.
Which is one of the vowels in Hebrew. It's drawn in the form of an I. I'm going to give you one guess as to what ain means in Hebrew. It's a noun.
Understand? Perceive?
That's a secondary connotation. It's not as primary as connotation.
Observe?
Eye.
Oh, eye. Well, yeah, eye and sight, of course.
Yeah, it means eye.
Dumb. Okay,
ain means
dumb.
Eye in Hebrew.
Yeah. Long week.
Yeah. Okay.
That makes sense to me.
Okay, so you've got, now you might say, so what's the, what is the big deal why do you care? You looked up Ra'ah, and it said shepherd. Why didn't you just leave it there? Yahweh is my shepherd. You know, Dode was a shepherd. That's a nice concept. Shepherds lead, shepherds nurture. Why not just leave it there? Because there's a reason that Ra'ah and Ra'ah sound the same and are only differentiated by the Aleph versus the Ain. And there's a reason that the Ain was drawn with an eye in the middle of it. It tells you about Yahweh's nature. It tells you that he is observant.
Without purpose.
That's right. You know, Yahweh constantly tells us that he observes his children. He pays attention to his children. He focuses on his children. It's really important to know that from Dode's perspective, when he depicted Yahweh as his shepherd, he is saying that Yahweh pays attention to me. He focuses on me. He observes everything that's happening around me. That's the only way that he can lead me, guide me.
Yeah.
And it tells us that in eternity, Yahweh is going to be observant right along with us. That Yahweh is not asking us to observe because he wants us to do something that's different than he's doing. He asks us to observe because he's observant.
Also
and he enjoys being observant.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting, it's an interesting point. You know, I brought this up a couple of weeks ago. I was in a debate and a guy, this was one about Yahweh not being omnipresent. That was my presentation. And this guy pulled out Dode saying, you wake me up and you put me to bed. He was equating himself with Dode, I mean, without even realizing what he was doing. And I said, well, you know, the guy that was most loved by Yahweh would be that way, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
You know, those politicians
and,
that
and by the
put
way,
into office that he didn't know.
That's exactly
be,
what Dode is conveying here. And that's what Yahweh conveys. If you are a member of the covenant, God wakes up with you. He goes to bed with you. He's there when you're standing up, and he's there when you're sitting down. There is no time in your life that God isn't part of your life when you become part of the covenant. Dode's statement is absolutely accurate. But did Yahweh have Cyrus or Nebuchadnezzar? Does Nebuchadnezzar or Cyrus say, you know, God wakes me up and he puts me to sleep at night. He's with me every step of the way.
No,
did he, have,
no he doesn't.
Did he have Pontius
goes,
Pilate say that?
No.
And so
and that's,
God's
that goes
not
to the,
with, right, God is with his children. He is not with his those who are not his children.
Yep, that's right.
Right. So you're right. He's right as it relates to you, Larry. God's with you all the time. There's no separating you and God anymore. He's with you all the time. He is always present in your life. But he's not present in 99.9999% of lives, and he's not present apart from his children. Even, you know, he's not out there. I've got a farm here. I'm looking out in the farm. He's not out there in the garden in the farm. Why would he want to be there? You know, no, he's not everywhere. And to be everywhere, he would cease to be relevant.
Well,
how, would you,
and
how
also,
would you walk to him if he was everywhere? If he was omnipresent, how would you walk to him?
Exactly.
If he was
you
everywhere,
would to, he'd be
how would you walk
you.
Away
yeah.
from him? If he was everywhere, how could you? How could he divorce himself of you or you? How could you be estranged from him?
Good point.
If he was everywhere, what choice would you have in terms of a relationship with him?
No, you'd be one with him.
You know, how could Yahusha say, I never knew you?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, there how are a thousand arguments against the omnipresent. The omnipresent idea is
absurd.
Hurtful. It's so stupid.
Truly, truly.
Well, I think they have to have a Lord there that's always watching them so, you know, it keeps them straight, you know, why the church robbed them. You know, I mean, these were the people that changed the meanings and the concepts. These were all, you know, religious guys that, you know, had a pretty nefarious goal in mind.
If God's
and,
everywhere,
and they,
then he is right there with the axe murderer. If God's everywhere,
no.
he's right there as the little child is being raped.
Yep. It's all true. You know, if people want to believe that, I mean, he said himself, you guys put people in charge, and I didn't know them. If he didn't know them, he wasn't with them.
You know, when Yahweh,
God controlling and micromanaging the world, God's everywhere, so, you know, he caused that accident to happen. You know, he allowed that kid to get shot. He allowed this kid to get hit by a car. He's everywhere.
My God,
so he's doing everything.
My God, why have you forsaken me?
Yeah,
if God is everywhere, how in the world did he separate himself from Yahusha?
Yeah.
Yeah, of all people. Of all people, by the way. You know, exactly. Yeah.
Well, don't you find it interesting when he was talking with Abraham and they were about to go down to Sodom and Gomorrah, he had the angels report to him. And the same thing about the story of the myrtle tree. He has the angels fly around and report to him. And why does he need anybody to report to him if he's everywhere and knows everything?
Because he doesn't want to see it.
He doesn't want to. No, he separates himself. Yeah, I don't blame him.
As the father of Abraham, it was important that he protect his child. And so he protected Abraham by getting that malignant cancer removed. But it wasn't, he had no reason to see it.
No.
Didn't care. Never did see it. So, a song of Dode, Yahweh is my shepherd. He is observant. He guides, nurtures, attends to, and protects me from Ra'ah, which means to see, to obtain understanding. I shall not be diminished, lo chasir. Shall not be decreased or made void, shall not be found lacking, shall not be abated, shall not be bereaved. This is in the call imperfect, which means this is forever, and this is literal. And the rest of this then comes to explain, since I'm not going to be diminished, I'm going to grow. I'm going to expand. I'm going to become, well, I'm going to receive the benefits of the covenant. He says, and before I read what he says, let's just read it in your English Bible. It says, he makes me, which sounds like, you know, he is being the Lord here because he's forcing him. He's forcing him to lie down in the green pastures. And he leads me beside quiet waters. I don't get the sense from Dode that Yahweh makes him do anything. I've never had God made me do anything. I've had
nothing about Dode's character really suggests that he's the kind of guy who lets anyone make him do anything.
I would agree.
I don't think he ever did anything against his will his entire life.
Yeah, and then we also talked about this. In a setting with animals, whether they be deer or sheep, if you were to lie down in grass around deer or sheep, around animals, you're going to be covered in bugs, including the most diabolical bug ever conceived, which is the chigger. And so the last thing anybody in their right mind, particularly a shepherd, is ever going to say is that you make me lie down in the grass. And if I walk across the grass of my farm, if I get off the road, and I walk across the grass of my farm, I like to look at it, it's pretty, but if I walk across it, I'm going to have 20 chigger bites that are going to be bugging me for 3 weeks thereafter. And that's just walking across it. That's not laying down in it.
Do you have fire ants up there, too? Like they do in the southern states? Yeah, well, that's even worse. Worse, as bad as chiggers.
No.
So not a good thing to do, lie in the grass.
No, so it's... He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. I know we talked about this today, but if you're going to drink water around animals, you darn well better not drink still water. If you drink still water around animals, you're going to get giardia. You're going to be sicker than a dog. You're going to be puking your brains out. So that is not a good thing. So he didn't say that. And by the way, as a shepherd, he would have known those things.
Mm-hmm.
So it says here, in an abode, a nahwa, a pasture or residence, a habitation or home. Nahwa is from na'ah, which means to become befittingly beautiful. So in a befittingly beautiful residence, conducive to growing, to sprouting out and shooting forth, to dash-a, to a place that brings forth life which grows, flourishing and abundant, provides the choicest, most nourishing, richest foods, which in Yahweh's parlance are his words, to consume, that facilitate vigorous health, abundant prosperity, tremendous new growth, total freedom, complete satisfaction, and, Delirio, like this, a stalwart attitude, uncompromising, unbending.
I love that, yeah, and that's where it should all be anyway, isn't it? You know, that's that's the hopelessness of the West. You know, when they put the tombstone up, it'll say that political correctness destroyed the West.
Yeah, you know. Stalwart attitude. I just love stalwart. It's just one of those great concepts. It means uncompromising, unchanging. Yeah, unwavering. A person who is stalwart stays the course. They're dependable, they're trustworthy, reliable. You can count on a person who's stalwart. And so dash-a speaks of growing, but in a fashion that's not all over the place. It's growing like a redwood, not growing like a multiflora vine. You know, it's just all over the place and all tangled. No, it's growing like a redwood, growing like an oak. Set strong, not wavering. And dash-a is just is such an interesting word. Three letters long. It's from dash-a, the verb, which means to bring forth life which grows. So this has nothing to do with green. I mean, dash-a is not the Hebrew word for green. Does not mean green. So in green pastures, forget it. Not green. In growing, thriving, sprouting out new life. Dash-a is only three letters long. Gert, what are the three letters tell us?
Let me start with a D, which is the doorway, which is the delete. And we think of the Passover door there. And the next one, of course, is the shin, the teeth, which is we identify that with knowledge and nourishing words.
Yep.
And, of course, the last one is the Aleph, which is the Almighty.
Yeah, the Almighty Shepherd. Aleph
Almighty
is
Shepherd.
The basis of Ab, Father, and of El, God. And El, God, combines the Aleph and the Shepherd staff. And and Father combines the Aleph and family home.
And it hits on every chord.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And it's amazing that Yahweh, in his favorite two titles, God and Father, uses this letter, which shows him as one of the sheep. Shows him as a ram, one of the sheep. How he wants to be. His choice. He created the universe. He could have chosen to be, the 800-pound gorilla amongst the little spider monkeys. But that's not the way that he wants to be. He wants to be one of the sheep. I want to be one of the flock. That's what he chose to do. I respect him for it. I think it makes him much bigger for him to take this diminished approach. Now,
it makes him more lovable.
Oh, yeah, but keep in mind, too, that by taking a humble approach, which is beneath his stature, he grows and gains the most.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, he did it thoughtfully. It's brilliant, his plan.
It's the perfect plan.
Yep. So
that's why I didn't want to hang around with people who are not on the same page. I mean,
yeah, that's right.
The whole purpose, that'll bring you down.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, even the word for abode, this residence, this befittingly beautiful place, it's nun wa he.
Mm-hmm.
To be a child born with an inheritance who receives all of the added benefits and increases associated with the wall, secured in and protected in an enlarged family home, so long as they're upright, paying attention, and standing up, walking with God.
Right.
It's conducive to growing, to sprouting forth, to shooting forth. this word is fantastic noun. It's an adjective, actually. He enables me to stretch out and recline appropriately sheltered after exerting myself. So the English Bible makes me lie down. I translate it instead as he enables me to stretch out and recline appropriately after exerting myself. Oh, you might say, why'd you do that? Because rabas, if you study rabas, it's not... there's a Hebrew word for I'm just going to stop. I'm going to cease doing what I'm doing. That's Shabbat.
Mm-hmm.
Shabbat means to cease. So if this was to be idle, just to cease to rest and reflect on what Yahweh had said, he would have used Shabbat, one of his favorite words. He didn't. So you have to figure out, okay, what is it about Rabbos that is different than Shabbat, so that we should not look at it as a sensation of activity. And what it says is that if you study the Hebrew lexicons, is that rabas was used of coming to a place of rest and reflection after considerable exertion. After a long journey, you can come back home and rest and reflect on what you've learned, what you've seen.
You know, also found to be restored, and there's no point in being restored if you haven't expended some energy to be, you know.
Right.
You have to expend energy before you do it,
right.
Too.
Exactly. And the reason I said enables as opposed to makes is that it was written in the hyphal stem. Now, the hyphal stem, the object, or the subject, which would be Yahweh, causes the object, which is Dode, to participate in the action, but it does so as a secondary subject. So it's a form of enabling that causes the object to be like the subject. So it's not Yahweh making Dode do something because he's controlling him. He's enabling Dode to be like him, to do the same things that he is doing. A vastly better concept than makes.
Mm-hmm.
So the expression of the stem here, establishing the relationship between Yahweh and Dode, is profound. Yahweh is enabling Dode to do these things so that Dode can be just like Yahweh.
Yahweh.
So he said, enables me to stretch out and recline appropriately sheltered after exerting myself above the Almighty's waters, calm and composed. So waters is mem, yod, mem. And all is ain, lamed. So this is ain, lamed would be the observant shepherd.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's because it's an eye and a shepherd's staff. It means Almighty. It means above. But pictorially, it is an observant, the Ain, Lamed, shepherd. So it's above the Almighty's water, Mem, Yod, Mem. So what is that? How would you define Mem, Yod, Mem?
Flowing waters, moving. Because I would, and then let's see. The observant shepherd.
You know, mem yod mem is yeah. Water. Yahweh's hand, water. All right, water.
All life springs from water. Even planets spring from water.
Right.
I mean, that's how I would look at that. I mean, that's life.
Yeah, even planets and stars and everything. It's the nursery of creation. Everything stems from water. Water is the symbol, however, of the set-apart spirit.
Yes.
And so this is Yahweh's hand on the set-apart spirit coming and going. And Yahweh's hand in the midst. So Yahweh enabling, directing, empowering the set-apart spirit. And the set-apart spirit is the is the very thing that Yahweh's home is based upon, that that enables us to do these things, to reach out, to extend ourselves, to grow, is the set-apart spirit. So we're all of this is because of the set-apart spirit. But then he says that he is Manuka, which means calm and composed. It doesn't mean that he is necessarily still, but the word means tranquil after coming to rest with a focus on the space now being occupied. That which was active and moving, extending itself, but has now returned from those experiences, satisfied and content. It's from Manukok, which is reposed, a state of being calm, of being composed, collected, and collected. And even the English word reposed is from the Latin reposare, which means to express the intensive force, and then after expressing a force, being able to pause. You know, it's kind of like even the Greek word that is translated to be meek. It means that you can control even the strongest animal or strongest, or you can prevail calm and composed in the most difficult circumstance. And so this is a calm and composed in the sense of, I shared today, when I fly as a pilot, I'm high. If I fall, I'm going to get hurt. And I'm going very fast, at least, you know, in human terms. You know, I can go 400 miles an hour and I can fly at 40,000 feet in elevation. And I'd better be calm and composed under those circumstances, or I'm going to be dead in a hurry. And now imagine your height limit isn't 40,000 feet, but instead 15 billion light years. And your speed isn't 400 miles an hour, but 186,000 miles a second. You better be pretty calm and composed. If you're going to examine the suns that comprise a galaxy, I think at that point you want to be calm and composed. So he said, you know, we're going to be operating in some really energetic worlds. We're going to be reaching out. We're going to be doing some things. And as we do it, we're not going to be all panicky and huffy and puffy and, oh, my God, oh, can you believe that? Oh, I can't even believe we just – you're going to come back and be calm and composed so that you can share it in a way that – and enjoy it, reflect upon it. Any of you ever been in a situation where the situation was so threatening that you got a rush of adrenaline?
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Number of times.
Yeah. And when you have that rush of adrenaline, your everything is heightened. But that's not the time you ever pause to rest and reflect on what you have done. You've got to calm down from that adrenaline rush so that you can reflect on what happened. You know, you don't attempt to fix the car when the wheel is over the leg of your son. You need the adrenaline rush to get the car off the leg, and then once you've got your son in the proper care, then you're calm and composed, and you can say, you know, well, this is what caused that. We don't want to have that happen again, and now this is how we're going to fix it. Calm and composed.
You get people that are addicted to that. I mean, they're just addicted to the rush. I had a friend of mine. He was a fighter pilot in Vietnam. He had 3,500. Carrier arrest, by all rights. He should be dead. Larry Elmore, one of the most laid-back, nice guys you'll ever meet. And he got me into skydiving. And so we started doing that. And last time I saw Larry, this was a number of years ago, it was just before TWA went belly up, I saw him from the corner of my eye in an airport behind a counter in a captain's uniform. So I went over and asked, do you have a Larry Elmore back there? Yeah, we have a Captain Elmore. I said, can I talk to him? He came out. He got so addicted to that. See, he was addicted to flying. And he got so addicted to the rush of jumping. He had over 2,500 jumps. And this is what happens today. I mean, now they've even got what they call wingsuits. And once
the guy that was American sniper? Mm-hmm. You know, the guy, the American Sniper? He got so addicted, he kept on. Even when he had a kid and, you know, a wife and a kid, he kept going over there because he was addicted to the kill.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, the wingsuit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you imagine jumping off a cliff in a wingsuit and taking that risk? Or these guys that climb freestyle up El Capitan. No rope.
Yeah, I know. I find that just totally insane, okay? And I watched a thing on wingsuits not too long ago. It was done back in 2013. Mm-hmm. And at the end of it, they did a kind of a memorial of names of all the wingsuit jumpers who had died that year. And it was about 30 of them. Well, there's not that many people doing it. So,
no,
you know, your odds of dying.
What is a wingsuit?
That's supposed to go climb K2. I mean, one out of every four or five people that tries to climb K2 dies in the pursuit.
I know. There is a rush that people get addicted to. Absolutely true. And
I'm not addicted to that rush. I don't like being fearful of my life. I've done rock climbing. But the rush that comes from the fear of what could happen is not a pleasing sensation to me. I love the view.
Well, there was a time I liked the rush, I'll tell you. And I didn't mind climbing rock, really. But now, I mean, if I see a movie and you know, they're at the very top of the highest building in the world and they keep showing me down, I get sick to my stomach. I really do. I can't stand it now.
So this is what this is saying, is that Yahweh's not interested in adrenaline junkies. He doesn't want people that are constantly flirting with death, who think that the only way to live is to be at the edge of death. That's not what he's interested in. He says that, yeah, we're going to reach out. Yes, we're going to explore. But we're going to be calm and collected about it.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And Kurt, you asked, what's a wingsuit?
Yeah.
You know, just pull up a YouTube on wingsuits and you'll see all it is. And these, it used to be that they would jump out of a helicopter, or they would jump off base jump.
Mm-hmm.
And they would just see how long they could fly. And they, believe me, they can fly for 30 miles.
It's a glider.
You know,
you're a human glider.
Oh, you're talking about
your arms and your body is a fabric that bends up and is shaped like a wing. And you have the same thing between your legs. So you spread your legs, you spread your arms, and your arms become your wings. And you become...
And you guide in just like you're parachuting. However, the thing with it is they went from doing that to now who can follow the contour of the earth and who can shoot between rocks.
The whole idea of the parachute is it slows you down. If you go slow in a wingsuit, you become a rock. You have to go fast.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not going fast, you'll die. You'll fall out of the sky.
Wow.
So it's an adrenaline rush. Are you willing to live at the edge of life? And if that is what excites you, then you're probably not going to like eternity, because you're never going, you know, in eternity, since you can't die, there can be no adrenaline rush from risking your life.
That can't be your thing. That's exactly right.
I'm standing on the event horizon of a black hole.
Not to make the covenant look wussy, because it's not.
Right.
The other thing is, you know, you got to be pretty bold. You got to be bold to be in the covenant.
You really have to be bold.
I mean, how would you like to be Daniel thrown into the lion's den?
Right. I'm bold in a calm and collected way. When I speak out against Islam, I realize that, particularly now with the Islamic State and their willingness to motivate Muslims here to go after those who speak ill of that son of a bitch they call a prophet, you know, to do that, you're taking a tremendous risk. And if you're not bold, if you don't have courage, you are not going to do it. And I choose to do it.
You were pretty bold when they had guns to your heads over your head over there.
But, you know, I was calm and I was
collected. How long did they have you in that position? Wasn't it a couple days?
No. It was about 5 hours.
Okay. Well, that sure seemed like a couple of days, didn't it?
Well,
I mean,
no, you know, it didn't because I am not an adrenaline rush guy. I never had any sense of fear.
Okay.
It never dawned on me that this was dangerous. Even when they were pointing the guns at my head and threatening to kill me, it never dawned on me that that could end my life.
That's pretty bold.
What it is, and it's calm and collected. I didn't know him well then. I know him well now. And so I just don't think there's some stupid things that I could do that would risk my life foolishly. But that is not one of them. That's not risk of one's life.
That explains the chit at the end of the word or right before the end of the word. I mean, that's separation, protection, a fence around you, protecting you. So, you know, where you have the men, none. Yeah. So that makes perfect sense, because otherwise there's no reason to have that in the letter, that letter in the word.
No, for it. That's exactly right. And then he says, he leads me to the light, Nahal. Now, Nahal can mean he guides, but this is typically translated. He leads me to still waters, and I'm just not getting any. I'm sorry, I don't get water here. Nahal is based on Nair. It's based on Nahar. Nahar is a stream of radiant light. And Nair is the Almighty's light.
And so, Halal is also a light.
Right. Yeah, Halal is radiant light. And so this
Nahal sounds like radiating light to me, to the light.
So the verb means he guides me toward the goal of enlightenment. And there is this concept associated with Nahal where, you know, or is the Hebrew word for light. And so there's more to it than that. You know, how all would mean to radiate light. But the thing that is added to it is that this form of light unburdens. It's not only a way that you're relieved and cared for and refreshed after a long journey by Yahweh's light. It's where your burdens are lightened. They flow away. So it's a very special concept of light. And it's really conveyed by the three letters. Nun,
hey,
lament.
But, you know,
a child
born
with an inheritance that stands up and walks with Yahweh as his or her shepherd.
I got ongoing, flowing and going like a river, but not saying it's a river, and to go on with the notion of care and protection, which is also in there as well. So, I mean, it's...
I think they talk about flowing into a river.
Yeah, that's...
I think they speak of flowing. I mean, the word does
flowing
have a concept
going,
of flowing. But
and that's not a still river.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not a still... This is a still anything. Right. It's going. It's ongoing.
This
continuing.
Is moving light.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it reminds me of Torah, which is the source from which teaching and guidance
flows.
You know, this is we're not being static here. We are flowing. That's why this concept of still waters is so silly here, because the verb speaks of flowing. But it's a flowing stream, if you will, of light.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we turn on a flashlight, we see a stream of light. Light flows to us as if it were a stream. And so that's what we're being guided to. Then he says, my soul. Now, by the way, why would he transition to soul if we were talking about him being a sheep laying down in a pasture?
Yeah.
What part of soul fits this metaphor unless we're talking about eternity?
Yeah, his inner core. Yeah, his real life.
Yeah, could you? I mean, how would you, even in your most twisted analysis, how would you justify the transition to soul if we're talking about laying down like sheep in a pasture of green grass? So, he affirms that we're talking about eternity because that's the only part of us that goes into eternity is our souls. My soul, my nephesh, my consciousness, my life, my ability to observe and respond, my persona and inner nature, my essence, my perspective, my attitude, my personality, my thinking, my desires, my passions and emotions. And I'm really cool about this because, well, there's lots of faults that I don't care about that I have. I really want my perspective, my personality to carry on. Otherwise, how am I going to even know who I am? I mean, how is anybody going to know who I am among the family? I want, when we get to eternity, I want to recognize Larry and JB's and Kirk's voice.
Mm-hmm.
I do. I want to recognize them.
And yeah, and obviously that's going to be the case because it isn't. It's an individual thing. It's not a collective.
Right.
You know,
right. Soul is individual and it is unique to each of us.
That's right.
And our soul is the seat of our own personalities and our attitudes. And that's what's going to make eternity interesting. We're going to meet Dode's soul. So my soul, he restores and returns. He shub. He turns around and brings back home. So here we are pursuing streams of light, and Yahweh takes our soul and he restores us, which means we've exerted some energy, and returns us home, brings us back home.
Mm-hmm.
He changes us to a preferable state,
preferable state,
accepting the previously estranged, is what shub means. Now, shub was written in the Peel Imperfect,
mm-hmm.
which means that God here, who is the subject, is acting on behalf of Dode, who is the object, and causing this transformation. So it's Yahweh that is causing Dode's soul to return, to come back home, restored. And that in the imperfect, it is forever, and he will eternally be part of God's family, his home. So my soul, he restores and returns. What was the last thing that Yahweh said right before this? Does he say he brings me to the light?
To that, yeah.
And do you think the light has something to do with him being restored?
Mm-hmm. His place of residence, yeah, his previous place of residence he's returning to, his home, sure.
Yeah. If you want to come home, you know, let's say that you were out there in the wilderness, wouldn't your preference be that someone shine a light?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if somebody builds a fire, you can see them. You can walk to them. Mm-hmm. If someone gives you a flashlight, you can see where you're going. And the most helpful thing is to have somebody shine a light. You want to know the way home? Go towards the light. So my soul, he restores with light. We don't. What is the way that God perfects flawed people?
Light.
Covers us with light.
Takes all the darkness.
Yep.
Yeah, all the darkness that goes away.
So it just explained it. You know, he brings us back home to the light. He leads us to the light. Our souls, he restores and returns. Now, this was the problem I had with the fellow that called Shattering Mist today, the Christian. He said, you know, I don't know what you believe. I kept on saying, why would you care what I believe? My beliefs are irrelevant. I'm not even sure if I have any beliefs.
Let's talk about what we
know. Why would you want to believe when you can know? Belief is what's required if you don't know.
I didn't have the opportunity to hear it. What was his response to that? Because, you know, you're talking reality again versus...
Changes. Every point I made, he changed the subject.
Changed subject, yeah.
When I began by saying, I can't believe, you know, why
another.
Would you say, yeah, I need to know what your beliefs are so I understand why you're criticizing the Apostle Paul and the New Testament. And so I explained why I criticized Paul, and the moment I did that, he changed the subject. And then he wanted to know about the validity of the New Testament, and I said, where does it speak of a New Testament? I know one place it speaks of a renewed covenant, and there's only one. And what does it say? And we went through Jeremiah 31, and I said, before we go through this, if I can prove to you using God's word alone that there is no New Testament and that the covenant will never become new and different, if I can prove that to you emphatically, will you leave Christianity? Because it's based entirely on that New Testament. And he waffled and waffled. And I said, well, I'm going to do it, and then it's your choice at the end. And then when I did that, what he immediately did is he said, well, then who do you say is Jesus Christ? I said, well, there is no Jesus, there is no Christ. You know when the letter J was first conceived? And he says, well, that's what we call him in English. I said, so you're not Dave in any other language but English? What, do you become Mortimer? And if I'm speaking to you in French, what if I say that I want to call you moron? What do you think about that? Well, what right do you have to change Yahusha's name? What right do you have to ignore Yahweh's name? And why do you use Christ as a last name when it's not even his title? And, you know, all they wanted to do was change the subject.
Yeah, what they think to do is just ignore mainly. That's what I've always seen. You hit them right between the eyes with Yahweh's words, and then they ignore that, and they act by ignoring it, sort of like a White House does, you know. We've already answered that.
Right, yeah, and I want to be really careful here. He did not do it in the belligerent religious way.
No, he wasn't.
Yeah, he was very open. He wasn't, antagonistic, but
right.
you could tell
he
seemed a bit overwhelmed.
He says, I know there's so many problems in Christianity that I'm really troubled by the religion. So he realizes there's all these issues with Christianity, troubled by the religion. And after he hung up, he called back into the show, and he says, you know, he recommended a book, and he asked Scott while we went on, he said, can you give me the website for that book again? I want to read it right now.
So well, good for him. I mean, that's how
I really hope he continues to listen. He seemed very open. He seemed overwhelmed more than anything.
Yeah.
Now, I will say one thing that drives me crazy is I hate when someone calls in, asks a question, won't let you finish answering, and then gets up because he did get a little upset at you at one point. He's like, you know, you won't let me talk, but like, you know, you asked a question. He's trying to answer your question. Let him answer it.
Right.
But he seemed a lot more open-minded than a lot of people. So.
Well, I mean,
I
and that's a good thing.
To listen, and I hope he does read.
Right. Well, the way I got here was I heard you on a Christian radio program. Mm-hmm. You know. And it was basically exposing Islam, but you didn't, there again, being a little bold, you didn't just attack Islam. You turn around and said, see, we got the same thing in Christianity, and here it is, and here it is, and here it is, and here it is. And you were right out front about it. And you used to walk into their churches and tell them what was wrong with their church. And there's a certain boldness to that. You know, there's people that have to be loved everywhere they go, you know. I'm not one of them. Obviously, you're not one of them.
You know,
probably
what,
none of us
when we're near
any of them.
I think this would be true of you. It was Kirk said it during our show. I think it was Kirk. Could have been Jason, but I think it was Kirk. And the comment was, all right, I began to read your translations of Yahweh's testimony and then connections that you made and what that meant relative to Christianity and what that meant relative to the covenant and the Torah. And each statement that you made added up. And they continued to add up. And everything added up. And finally, you're in a position where you've had so much reinforcement and so much confirmation that you've been led from faith in something that was worthless and untrue to a knowledge and an understanding in the very instructions that were given to us by God.
Yeah, well, I've certainly said that to you before on occasion, so, I mean, that's exactly, it's overwhelming. You can't debate
and that. It is overwhelming, but that's exactly what everybody else says, too. You know, you're talking
negatively
about people. We have another girl named Lisa that came in to the truth here several months ago. And she began reading notes and reading ITG and reading Yada Yah and reading, you know, Bless Yahweh site. And she had went out and established her and some friends had established their own church group some, I guess, more than 10 years ago. And there were, I guess, her and six others. And, you know, as you can imagine, you know, you're a small group that meets every week for 10 years or 12 years or whatever it was. And Lisa Baskin is her name. I mean, she could call in and tell us. But, you know, you become very close with those people. I mean, you know, you're sharing your beliefs. You're strengthening each other's beliefs. I mean, that's really what you're doing in a church. And, you know, when she started presenting the truth to these people, they fell apart. They fell apart. And, of course, she's no longer with the group. But she, exactly what you just stated is exactly what I said. It's exactly what she says. It's probably what all of us say, is that suddenly it all fit together. There was no big hole anywhere that you had to ignore.
That's true up to a point. And that is that if you're willing to wrestle the issue down, if you're willing to grab hold of something and not let go until you get resolution, then everything adds up. Mm-hmm. But if you listen to something that is contrary to what you've been led to believe and radically different, and when you're exposed to the truth about it, you simply go on to the next issue. And you don't wrestle anything down. You never get to the point. You never get to acceptance, to understanding. If you just constantly move from one thing to another, I'm not sure that it ever adds up, because it's just all flowing through your fingers.
We've had people that do that too. I mean, we had one fellow that came in. In fact, he called in on this show one evening and said he was a street preacher. A little slow. And now he's become he went from pillar to post and cheap website to cheap website constantly. I mean, five times a day sometimes asking me a question when, you know, over a year's time I'd given him Yada Yah and ITG and everything else. I mean, he had the ability to go study it. Well, this guy says this. What do you say? Doesn't matter what I say. Here's Yahweh's words. This is what he says. Oh, okay, thanks. Today, he's a loony Shabbat guy, and he's a vegan. He's a vegan. And he doesn't believe Yahusha came at all. So, I mean, whatever they rewrote and believe from bouncing around from place to place, there are people that don't have the ability to focus.
Right.
You have to be able to focus.
And that's really the key. Yeah, that's why observation, shamar, the Hebrew word for to observe, means to focus, to keep your focus on something so that you closely examine and carefully consider. If you don't do that, if you're moving on to the next point before you've wrestled the last one down, until you've come to grips with the last one, it's why, you know, I don't like to share translations unless I've also shared the insights and the connections and the understanding that's gleaned from that. If you don't wrestle it down, I think sometimes it can do you more harm than good. You need to wrestle it down. You need to focus on it to the point where you've moved from just casually hearing it to actually knowing it and then understanding it.
But you've never been one to not lay out all the reasons why you are doing something this way or why you're translating this way, which is extraordinarily helpful, and you always give us the Hebrew words in your translation, so even in my early stages I could go to those things and say, okay, let me look up all these things and see where he's coming from, even though you have a lot of tons of commentary to begin with. You've always said, some people translate it this way, this is I know is right, or this I'm not sure about, or this would make a lot more logical sense. So you don't just throw something out and say, trust me.
And that's because once you engage and start doing it on your own and checking it and following that procedure, then you come to a vastly superior position than if you're simply hearing it. When we engage that, that's what occurs. Now, what I was going to tell this fellow, because he called in and his question was going to be with Scott, you know, how does one become saved? And I'm going to use this example. I said, okay, I'm going to use this example. You live in Greenville, and I live in Blueville. And you're over there in Greenville, and you say, you know, there's a lot of crime in Greenville. There's a lot of unfair things, a lot of graft and greed and violence over here in Greenville. I want it out of Greenville. I want to come to Blueville. I want you to save me and bring me to Greenville. But you know nothing about me. You know nothing that's going on here in Blueville. You don't know if there are standards and expectations in Greenville. You have no idea if there's things in Blueville that you would like or not like. And yet, over there in Greenville, because you don't like Greenville and you want out of Greenville, and you know that everybody in Greenville eventually dies and people in Greenville get sick, you want me to save you over here to Blueville. But you don't know who I am. You don't know what it's like over here. And would you think that if I were over here, first of all, why would you even want to be saved by me and come over here when you don't have a clue what I'm offering and who I am? I could be a demon for all you know. And beyond all that, let's just say that I was a good guy and this was a good place over here in Blueville. And we didn't have any of that religious or political or military corruption over here in Blueville. And you were a Greenvilleite. Why would I want you to pollute Blueville? Why would I save you? Why would I bring you in here if you were going to bring Greenville with you? What's the difference between that and our mortal existence and Yahweh's spiritual realm, his family?
Well, you wouldn't.
We're in Greenville.
You know, you're over here, and say you've got this land where people help each other, people share with each other, people love each other, people enjoy each other's conquests and achievement. And you're always patting each other on the back. And I mean, I don't mean in some negative way or pejorative way, but I mean in a way where you're always advancing Tob, as it were. Right. And then you bring in this guy who's the most negative jerk in the world that runs everything down. Why would you want him around? You know, I mean, if this was the difference in the two worlds, and the difference between the religious monster god and Yahweh are even greater than that. So,
right. Now, if you're in Greenville and your God is the Lord, and over there in Blueville, God is the Father, why would he want to bring somebody in that wants to worship him when there's no worshiping going on here in Blueville?
Yeah, that's obviously why he had entire tribes wiped out. And what they were about is reflected in their very names. And the very words used to describe them. And these were all primarily either militaristic, religious, or political. You know, every one of them.
My soul he restores in return. He wants to guide me when I trust him. You know, what good is a guide if you don't trust him? What good is trust?
None at all.
If the person you're trusting isn't going to guide you effectively, is this... this relationship with, you know, in the covenant, Yahweh says that he wants us to rely on him. He wants us to stop relying on human institutions. He wants us to rely on him. Well, the means to reliance is trust. That is trust. I mean, trust is the means to trust is knowledge. And so this is really key. You have to understand that the Torah is guidance that creates a knowledge and through teaching so that we come to know who Yahweh is, we come to understand what he is offering, and when we come to know and understand, we're in a position to trust his guidance. That's the reason I think prophecy is so important. That's why I'm so glad I wrote Yada Yah before Intro to God. Intro to God teaches us the path that Yahweh has provided to become part of his family and tells us what he's interested in. But isn't it first important to trust, to be able to trust Yahweh? And the only way you can come to know him and trust him is to use the proof that he he has provided, that he authored this book of instructions?
Yeah.
And the prophecy proves that he authored it, that he exists.
Otherwise, we could go read some Hindu nonsense that talks about their trinity of everything's got a trinity of gods, you know, and,
right.
and you're right back to Babylon again. And anybody can say anything they want. You can read a book by, you know, some philosopher and it sounds good, but it really isn't true. And he doesn't prove any of it's true. He just sounds good.
And
that's really what religion
seeks
to do.
It says, you know, he wants to guide when I trust him. You can't trust someone you don't know. And so that's implying he wants us to know him, and he wants to prove that he's knowable. And that's what the purpose of prophecy. It's the purpose of the detailed creation account, which is so stunningly accurate in science and in time. It's the purpose of that flood account, which is so accurate in science, scope, and time. It's the reason for all of the profound prophecies about Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim, and the fourth day of creation and what's going to occur, and Yahweh's timeline, and then all of the prophecies about what's going to happen as time unfurls. It's to prove that he exists and that he authored these books, and therefore, because he has provided such precise and accurate information about all of these things, you can trust him on the family covenant. That's why it exists. It's important to celebrate the prophecies and the histories and the scientific explanations, because they demonstrate conclusively that we can know him and that we can trust him. So he wants to guide when I trust him. It's Nuach. It is his will to settle me spiritually by leading me reliably with his words, creating an opportunity for a favorable state where good things will occur when I depend on him. Now, the word is Nuach, which is Nun, Wa, and then the hard CH sound. And it is related to Ruach, which is a Rosh Wa and the hard CH sound. Ruach is spirit. It's related to Nuach, which is to speak in anticipation of a welcoming event. It is from Naka, which means to depend on and to trust, leaning on someone who is reliable. So this is spiritual guidance based upon trust and dependable leadership. That someone whose words are reliable, someone who creates positive opportunities which are dependable. It tells us that we can rely on him. We can know him. We can rely on him. He's going to teach us. He's going to lead us. He's going to guide us. And that's what he wants to do. You know, when I've said, and I've probably said it on every program, it sounds like a broken record here, and I apologize for that, but I've said that my last frustration with Yahweh was that it took so much energy and effort to understand what all of these things mean and how they work together, what Pesach represents, what Matzah represents, what Bikurim represents, what Shavuah represents, what the Shabbat represents, what his timeline is, what the terms and conditions of the covenant are, what the benefits of the covenant are, how those things relate, what the Torah represents. It takes time to study these things and then think about them and make the connections to understand. And I just wonder, you know, why God didn't just make it so much simpler? Why didn't you say that Passover is the doorway to life? Why didn't you tell me that matzah is the threshold by which we are cleansed, that yeast represents sin, and sin is religious and political animosity to you, and that's what's being taken away from our souls? And why didn't you say that Bikurim was the firstborn children and how you're adopting us into your family. Why not just say it that way? You know, why set the Exodus in history? Why have Abraham enact Passover for us? Why not tell us that you sukkahed with us so that when you arrived, that was it? Why didn't you just tell us that you're going to return on Yom Kippurim and that you're going to establish the last 1,000 years of sukkah? Why don't you just lay it out for us? Why didn't you say there's 5 terms and conditions of the covenant? This is what I expect if you're going to be part of my family. Why didn't you just lay it out for us?
But look how much fun.
That was my frustration. What does this say? He wants to guide me when I trust him. Yeah, what fun would that be? For him, for us? What kind of a life would that be if God has so little respect for us that he says, you know, you're so stupid, you're so incapable, you're so boring, that I'm just going to give you the 5 points, accept the 5 points, and then you can be saved. Yeah, man, how would you learn?
Maybe you don't want to hang around people who don't even care enough to try.
Right. You know, people say, you know, your books are too long. Give me a one-page summary.
I was crying when I was getting to the end of it, so I read it again until you finally came out with it.
Yeah.
I was saying, oh, no, I'm down to only 28 more pages. Oh, gosh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But, you know, the second time through, you learn 10 times.
Yeah, even more.
So what Yahweh is saying here is, I told you all that stuff, but I told you in such a way that you've got to want to find it, you've got to focus on it, you've got to think about it, and you can make the connections. And by the way, once you've thought about it and made the connections, you're going to say, okay, well, that was pretty obvious. If you had made it anymore.
Well, yeah, I mean, it also makes you a considerate person.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah, it does. And it means that once you come to know it, you say, wow, and it's confirmed in so many different ways that now you can share that path with somebody. And I told, you know, yeah, Roy wrote me an email after our last, the guy from the Scientific Mind from Australia. And Roy sent me an email after our last, because he was giving credit to the Set Apart Spirit for all of the connections and insights that he has. And, you know, he has some profound insights. The guy is right.
Well, it sounds like somebody else I know. So
yeah,
okay.
And what I said, Roy, I don't do that anymore. There was a time where I gave the Set Apart Spirit credit for the insights. I just don't do that anymore. And I said, I want you to understand why I don't do it. And I sent this letter to you, Larry, and to some other people. Kirk, I sent it to you, and I sent it to Richard. I said, the reason I don't do it anymore is, A, that I'm prone to mistake. For example, if I had given the Set Apart Spirit credit for me referring to the Christian New Testament as the Renewed Covenant, I would be crediting her for deceiving me.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't deceive me.
That's a good point, you know.
I wasn't rational enough. I hadn't studied all of the information well enough to come to the right conclusion. So what I said to him is that, yes, I understand the role the Set Apart Spirit plays in helping me understand. I'm all over that. She is a tremendous light as it relates to our understanding. But I think it is far more valuable, rather than to credit the Set Apart Spirit with our insights, because at the moment you do that, you take credit away from the process we use to come to those insights, which is we studied Yahweh's Word. It was Yahweh's Word that was the source of those insights, and it was the process that we used to come to know what he said using the oldest sources, going to the root of the words, looking at the way the letters were drawn, looking at the actionable form of each word, coming to understand the stems, the conjugations, and the moods. It was by diligently focusing on his testimony and making connections with other things he said and viewing it from the proper perspective that all of these insights were derived. And so what I said, you know, I think it's more valuable to tell people the process that you used. What were you doing and how did you come to these conclusions? What were you examining? How were you considering it? And then how did that process lead to these conclusions? I said, if you can share that, then you're empowering others to even go beyond what you have learned.
Speaking from experience, that's what helped me the most.
Yes.
Well, think about how smart we're going to be in another 5 years if we keep doing this.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it's, you know, in terms of insights, Yahweh's word provides the insight when we're focused on it, when we're diligent, when we take the time to understand it. I didn't know 3 weeks ago that the 23rd Psalm was a depiction of life and eternity. Never dawned on me.
No.
Yeah, but that's what it
no,
is.
No, because when we look at it from the perspectives that we were taught it from, everything's physicalized, isn't it? Everything's physical. Everything's right here, right now.
This world, right.
Yeah.
You know, I heard a guy misquote, you reap what you sow, just yesterday, you know.
Yeah.
You know, some killer was killed. Okay, good enough. Well, how about these guys like Kissinger? I mean, has he's going to reap what he sowed, but he certainly hasn't yet.
No.
You know, I mean, this is, you know, in this life, you know, he might even have a monument built to him, depending on when he dies here, hopefully soon.
The jihadists that teach little kids to cut off their parents' heads.
Okay. Yeah.
And they live another day.
Sure. And what they don't understand, we do. I mean, that's a very simple concept. You reap what you sow. You sowed death. You didn't say anything that advanced life. And so, in the end, you're going to die. And we know what that means. But, you know, there are people that take that out of context, just as one example. And that's what they've done with this psalm, this song. They've taken it and they've tried to somehow morph it into this physical world, and it doesn't work that way.
You know, Larry, what I told him today, I said in the last 4 months we've wiped out, or he's wiped out more than, you know, I got to ride along, so that's great fun. But he's wiped out the ironic blessing that all the preachers close their little performance
on. Yes,
that
was
think about this. He's wiped that out totally. Yeah. Right. He's exposed John 3 and the Christian easy way to salvation. Beyond belief.
3:16. Yeah.
And now he's destroyed the last vestige they have in Psalm 23 of the most popular funeral speech in the history of mankind.
Yeah, and of course,
I mean,
all of that.
That's pretty good. Yeah, that's a pretty good first quarter.
Yeah, yeah.
The ironic blessing was beautiful. That was absolutely beautiful.
Well, look what he's doing. Well, look what he did to John 3:16 and now Psalm 23.
All we did. Is study the words.
I know.
That's what he actually said.
But you know, you've got to be really rational about the words. And you've got to consider the words in context.
Yeah.
That's why, you know, if you come into, for example, Yahweh Kanan 3 in context, it's profoundly different than if you don't. Another great one is we were talking about call him the Christ, that those that will call me the Christ, and they will mislead many. And when you read context of where he came from, he just left the temple in Jerusalem, and he spoke to the Israelites as to how he wanted to be the set apart spirit and put them under his wings and that circumstance. And then when he said that they were asking him questions, and he said, you know, not one stone is going to stand upon another, and it's all going to be torn down. And then he says, you know, why is it that you don't see all of these things? And you realize that in context, man, he's talking about Roman Catholicism. He's talking about Pauline doctrine. He's setting up how come you can't understand the difference between my father's house, the centerpiece of the Torah, my family, my father's house, and my desire with the set-apart spirit to protect my children, and the tearing down of this my home. Why can't you make those connections and understand who is doing it? And then he, the next statement out of his mouth is, there's going to be lots of people that call me the Christ, and they're going to be misleading many. Well, isn't that what Christians all call him?
Sure.
And so he's right back to the religion of Christianity. And then you consider what he said after that, and in context, it's so easily understood with an open mind, the right perspective. So, you know, I personally, I think when we share the process that leads to understanding, then we are far more helpful than we could be any other way. Because if you can walk through the same words and come to the same conclusion, then, you know, you own it. You know, Larry, there was something that you did, I don't know if it was probably 4 or 5 years ago, but you made a significant transition from, you know, you kind of had your finger on something that I translate and you'd share something I translate with somebody, and that would be kind of it, to the point that you know this material. I mean, you know it inside and out and in between. And when you're citing something, you're just citing it from Yahweh. You're not citing it from me. And you, when you made that transition, it's powerful. It's hugely impactful.
Oh, yeah. It is. It really is. I mean, it's a hard way to... It's a stretch to say you care what the creator of the universe says and not listen to him all at the same time.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I kept on saying, okay... Paul calls the Torah in Greek pornography. He says that cannot save. He says that the covenant in the Torah enslaves. Now, Yahweh said exactly the opposite. So, who are you going to believe? Are you going to believe the Creator God of the universe, or the man who contradicted?
And incidentally, when he said that. Isn't that off? That's off Papyrus 42, I think. Am I right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's extant. There's nothing older that Paul wrote.
That's
so.
Right.
How is it that these people that
within 20 years of the time that he wrote it?
Then how is it? How is it that people who tap dance for Paulos, when you show them that, and you show them this is extant, there's nothing older, there's no way around this, they just play blind and dumb.
Dumb.
I mean, you can't take the root word of pornography. It's right there. I mean, you cannot see it any other way.
Yeah, he calls it the old system of writings, which is translated in English, the Old Testament, is porneros.
That's right.
What he says. The old system of writings.
Now, how do you get out
the
of
old
that?
Test-
How do you get
it's
out
Poneros.
Of that? What do you do, play Swatchy and go, oh, well, he didn't write that entire book. But he did write
this
book.
Yeah, but then, okay.
I mean, is that
then
how you do
Romans,
it?
In Romans
so why,
7,
why
he says he equates the Torah to a dead husband.
Yeah. Yeah, he does.
it's
shocking.
Yeah,
but porno, I mean, it's in your face. I mean, there's no way around it.
No, there's no way around it. No, it's the most liberating thing you can do in your pursuit of truth, if you've formerly been a Christian, to start questioning Paul and to finally let go of him. And once you've done that, your perspective now is always clear. The place that you stand is unwavering. It's stalwart.
It's over in Yashayahu, and remember we did a night on this. I did a note out of it where he talks about the spirit of discernment and the spirit of this and the spirit of that and the spirit of wisdom, you know. And he says, and I'm not going to adjudicate from my physical self, you know, but on the entire spiritual endeavors, he's saying, you know, you want to look at the entire Moed Mikra here. You don't want to look at just, you know, my diminished physical manifestation. Now, we've got Paul. When does he talk about the spiritual endeavors? The only thing he talks about, even though he will not quote Yahusha, which is another wild thing, but the only
I'm
thing
speaking
he focuses
for him, he appointed
on
me,
physical
but I'm never going to quote him. Yeah, I'm never going to quote
him. Now, how do you focus just on the physical appearance? How do you do that?
Yeah.
He said absolutely not to do that.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Yosha was a infinitely superior to Paul or any human from any criterion. And when Yosha was here, what was his primary source of information? Who did he quote them? Did he say, "But I, Yosha, say ever once"?
Never.
Or did he simply cite the Torah, the prophets?
Does the Torah not say?
Right. So, if it was good enough for Yosha to quote this Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and Paul claims that he's speaking for him and he doesn't quote them accurately and never quotes Yosha, and his favorite line is, "But I, Paul, say"? Reminds me so much of that, the most hurtful line that Yosha ever said, that "I have come in my Father's name, and you have not accepted me. But another, he will come in his own name, and him you'll accept." And you tell me, anybody in history other than Paul that could be written of?
Well, anyone, you have to really specify it to their lifetime, because he was speaking to them.
Right.
There's only one person in their lifetime that came in his own name.
That is correct. One. And it happens to be the same person that was the false apostle that was argumentative against Yahochanan in Ephesus and made a big stink about it. The purpose of the...
Said he had to rebaptize all the people, didn't he?
Right.
Didn't
he?
Yeah, because Yahochanan had baptized in the wrong spirit. You got to love that.
Only one. There's only one person who came as a wolf in sheep's clothing, a Benjamite wolf, who claimed himself to be a chameleon, that he would be anything to all people, another to gain an advantage. There's only one person that that did that in their lifetime. There's only one person that claimed to see him in the wilderness, which he warned against. I mean, no matter how you look at it, and there's only one Shaul that was born at the time of the Moed Mikre being fulfilled that claimed
Gentiles in Jerusalem, no doubt.
Yeah, that was opposed to circumcision, named Shaul for crying out loud, and he said he was the plague of death. I mean, how much more information do you want?
Yeah, and how they're going to meet in his name. They're going to meet in his name all over the world. Right. All over the world.
Yeah. Yeah, and,
how do people deal with that in a seminary when they actually read that? I mean, it's one thing.
They don't make the connection. And the Christian way of dealing with that is they translate Shaul as Sheol, and so they say that the he singular masculine individual that has a soul is Sheol, but Sheol is a place, not a person, and Sheol does not have a soul.
Yeah, it talks about his soul. His soul.
Right, and
yeah,
Sheol does not focus on the masculine genitalia. It doesn't have a focus on Gentiles. I mean, it's impossible for it to be Sheol. Yeah, but again, it's like the Lord is my shepherd. Do you think there's any seminary that said that's impossible? That's an oxymoron?
Or maybe we ought to at least think about this for a minute? Yeah.
We ought to think about this for a
minute? They look at it as little words. But, you know, I think there was somebody that said, you know, I don't want to debate semantics with you, but, you know, as you aptly point out, semantics is really the study of words, you know. Words mean things. And, you know, it's a little tweak here and it's a little tweak there. And before you know it, you got a bunch of religious sounding hokum is what you've got.
Yeah, you're in an extremely visual profession, Kirk, where you're an artist and you draw. But when you teach art, would you be able to teach art if you couldn't use words to explain why and how you're doing things?
No, I think they'd like me to shut up sometime. I talk so much.
Yeah, but it's the words that explain the method, the process that you're using and the concept behind it.
Yep.
You're going to explain the nature of light, the importance of perspective, of contrast, of contour, of dimension, of being observant. If you were to have your words taken away from you, is there any way that you could teach?
No.
No.
Absolutely not.
Yahweh has chosen a singular method of communicating with us.
Without words, you can't think.
No, you can't think. No, without words, you can't think. Without words, you can't communicate. Without words, you can't learn. Without words, you can't engage in a relationship. No, everything that we do is predicated with words. We think about it first.
Yeah.
Think in words. Yeah, if I'm going to be convicted of doing something to excess, the thing that I want to be condemned for doing to excess is overly fixating on Yahweh's words.
Yeah, I don't think you can go wrong there.
No.
No. That's what Shamar, Dabar, means. Shamar Torah. Focus on his words. Well, fellas, we've gone past the 2 hours.
Uh-huh.
It's been fun.
Enjoyed it.
Got us into this 23rd Psalm. We got a lot more to do on the 23rd Psalm. We'll be in it for a while, but we'll just keep right on at it. And,
good
evening. I'll translate more this weekend, and I'll shoot more of it to you guys as I write it. But it's at this point, it is it's for family. I'm not pretending this is anything more than my own fascination with the psalm, and so I'll share it with you is my own personal fascination with the psalm, and it's for family, and would encourage everybody to examine it and challenge it and think about it and see where it leads them. But this is my own fascination with these words and what these words mean, and I'm just scratching the surface at this point. I haven't worked this to the point where I'm comfortable with it being anything other than kind of an initial perspective.
Yeah. It's a good first draft.
So this first draft, we're scratching the surface.
It's been revealing thus far.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it gets better. It gets better. Doe's really an insightful guy. As we said, we began this program. There was no one in all of known history that was less Torah obedient, and there's no one in all of history that was more Torah observant.
Observant.
Yeah.
What a contrast.
Indeed.
All right, fellas. Good night.
Good night. Happy Shabbat.
Happy Shabbat. Next week.
Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.